Hello, it is Thursday, the 11th of June. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. Coupang, the e-commerce giant, has been fined more than 620 billion won, or more than $400 million, for alleged violations of personal privacy laws. More on that on News Briefing. On today's in-depth news analysis, we'll talk about the latest flare-ups in the war in Iran and what that could mean for future peace talks and potential implications for Korea. Plus, on Explore Korea, we'll be joined by Cho Jung-woo, who will share the lush and green details of a garden show that's taking place right here in Seoul. All that and more on Korea 24. E-commerce giant Coupang has been fined a total of around $409 million for the massive personal information breach that affected 37.5 million of its customers last year. It's the largest fine to date for a single data breach in the country. Our KBS World Radio News reporter, Pae Ju-yeon, joins us in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Ju-yeon.
Hello, Andrew.
The government has slapped Coupang with fines and other penalties amounting to around 624.7 billion won, or again, some $409 million, over the massive personal information breach that occurred last year. Ju-yeon, give us the details, please.
The Personal Information Protection Commission announced on Thursday's decision against the e-commerce giant for the data breach. Let's listen to what its chair, Hong Kyung-hee, said.
개인정보 유출 및 타사 온라인 활동 정보 무단 수집 행위에 대해
We determined that the leakage of personal information and the unauthorized collection of third-party online activity information constituted violations of safety measures and the collection and use of personal information. Therefore, a total fine of 624 billion 681 million won and an administrative penalty of 16.8 million won were imposed.
The data breach compromised the names, phone numbers, addresses, and order histories of nearly two-thirds of South Korea's adult population. Song cited problems in Coupang's basic security management system as to what led to the data breach. This is what she said.
The committee's investigation revealed that this incident occurred not due to sophisticated hacking methods, but due to Coupang's inadequate basic security management system and negligence. Coupang has grown its e-commerce service significantly based on vast customer data, but the company did not have a system to protect and manage customer information despite its business scale.
2 weeks after the leak was discovered in November last year, President Lee Jae-myung criticized Coupang's C-suite for failing to detect the unauthorized network intrusion for nearly 5 months. The data breach has also strained South Korea's ties with the U.S., which has accused Seoul of using the case as an excuse to unfairly target a successful American company.
Has there been a response from Coupang on the penalties?
It expressed regret and said it will launch a legal challenge to dispute the penalties, which are the highest ever in a case of this nature in South Korea, as we mentioned earlier. In a statement issued on Thursday, Coupang said it expects to clarify the facts surrounding the data leak through legal procedures. The company said it regrets that its proactive measures to prevent secondary harm from last year's data leak incident, as well as its explanation based on clear facts, were not sufficiently reflected in the commission's decision. Coupang also rebutted the commission's claim that it failed to properly oversee advertising partners that posted so-called kidnapping ads and said it uses the same affiliate model as other global companies in compliance with relevant laws protecting customer data.
Now let's get the latest on the president's European tour. President Lee Jae-myung met with EU leaders on Wednesday. Ju-yeon, tell us about the highlights of that meeting.
At the EU headquarters in Brussels, President Lee met with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and European Council President Antonio Luis Santos da Costa. In the meeting, South Korea and the EU decided to launch negotiations toward a bilateral information security pact as part of efforts to boost defense cooperation. Let's listen to what the European Commission head had to say.
Today, we decided to start negotiations on a security of information agreement. These are just some of the many reasons why I say with confidence that Korea is one of Europe's closest partners in the Indo-Pacific region and on the global stage. And I'm deeply convinced that the best is yet to come. Because In today's uncertain world, stable and trusted partnerships like ours are more precious than ever.
South Korea and the EU are reformulating their ties amid geopolitical uncertainties, including conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East. The envisioned Security of Information Agreement Pact is designed to enable the two sides to safely share and protect classified intelligence and sensitive data. Let's listen to President Lee's comments on Wednesday's meeting.
오늘 회담에서 저는 북핵 문제 해결과 한반도 평화 정착을 위해 유럽연합의 변함없는 지지와 건설적인 역할을 강구하고 우리 양측이 함께 협력해 나가기로 조치를 모았습니다. 또한 최근 중동 정세와 관련해 중동 내 평화와 안정이 조속히 회복되고 호르무즈 해협의 즉각적 개방과 선박의 자유로운 통항을 보장하는 것이 매우 중요하다는 점에 우리 양측은 의견을 함께하였습니다. 우크라이나의 평화 회복과 재건을 위한 양측의 기여 의지도
제안합니다. In a joint statement, the two sides condemned military cooperation between North Korea and Russia, calling it illegal and a factor in enabling Russia to continue its war on Ukraine.
Were any agreements produced in that meeting?
Yes, the two sides signed a digital trade agreement seeking to make digital transactions easier, supplementing a free trade pact that entered into force in 2011. Take note that the EU is South Korea's third largest partner in goods trade, while South Korea is the eighth largest partner for the EU member countries.
Staying on the president's tour, President Lee arrived in Italy for a state visit, the second stop on his European tour. Chiyun, what's on his itinerary during this trip?
Well, two Italian fighter jets escorted, let me first tell you about his arrival. Two Italian fighter jets escorted the presidential plane Wednesday as it entered Italy's airspace in a show of respect, and he was welcomed by a lineup of Army, Navy, Air Force, and police personnel after landing at Rome Fiumicino Leonardo da Vinci International Airport. The South Korean leader is set to host summit talks with Italian President Sergio Mattarella on Thursday, followed by a joint press announcement and a state dinner. On Friday, he is scheduled to hold a summit with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and attend an event to exchange memorandums of understanding between the two sides. As we broadcast Korea 24 on this Thursday evening, he and Mattarella are soon expected to wrap up their bilateral talks and hold a joint news conference. We are going to bring more information about the summit tomorrow.
For our final story today, police have commenced a raid of the National Election Commission headquarters and regional election commissions as part of an investigation into ballot shortages during the June 3rd local elections. Chiyun, fill us in on this raid.
The Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency began the search at 9 a.m. Thursday at the NEC headquarters in Gwacheon, Gyeonggi Province. It also raided regional commissions in Seoul's Songpa, Seocho, Gangnam, Gwangjin, and Dongjak districts, where ballot shortages were reported. The police agency said with the raids, it is focused on securing evidence that will shed light on the ballot shortages, which has violated the people's right to vote. The election watchdog and the regional commissions could face charges under the Public Official Election Act and breach of duty charges, with former NEC chair Noteak and former Secretary General Ho Chol-hun and others listed as suspects on the search warrant.
And that's all we have for today's news briefing. Thank you, Jian.
Thank you, Andrew.
Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Annyeong, Korea. This is Bob Layton, co-creator of Iron Man. You are listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Attacking them very hard.
You're resuming bombing?
We are. Based on the helicopter, I guess we have the right to do that. You know, they shot down a very...
The United States launched a second day of airstrikes in Iran hours after President Donald Trump warned American forces would hit Iran, quote, hard. Speaking to reporters at the White House Wednesday, Trump pressed Iran for a deal to end the war.
But we hit them hard yesterday, and We're going to hit them again hard today, in case you miss it, in case you don't turn on your television set. And we'll see what happens with the deal. We were really close to a deal, but they keep tapping us along. They keep playing us for suckers because, you know what? They dealt with some very stupid presidents. I have to say that. I'm embarrassed to say it. Some very stupid people.
Trump told Fox News on Wednesday that the, quote, self-defense strikes involved the deployment of 49 Tomahawk missiles and reportedly hit positions about 60 kilometers outside Tehran and along Iran's southwestern coast. As the ceasefire between the two sides continued to crumble, Iran's state TV reported Thursday that the country's joint military command declared the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. To get a handle on what these developments mean, whether we're seeing a major escalation or perhaps extra fire before a peace deal, we've asked two professors to provide their insights. What do these strikes mean, not just for the conflict, but also for trade flows and the Korean Peninsula? And what can we expect next? We have on the line Professor Robert Kelly, a.k.a. BBC Dad, and political science professor at Busan National University and International Relations, Professor Daniel Pinkston at Troy University. Hello, gentlemen.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, great to be here.
Okay. So for the first question, we go to Professor Kelly. U.S. Central Command said it had completed its second consecutive day of, quote, self-defense strikes, launched overnight after Trump said Tehran had taken, quote, too long to make a deal to end the war and would now, quote, again, have to pay the price. This followed Iran downing a U.S. Army helicopter the day before. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, in response, launched strikes back at U.S. bases in the region in Bahrain, Jordan, and Kuwait. Professor Kelly, what's your take on the latest situation? What do these strikes mean for the war?
Yeah, I'm not sure that sort of these individual tit-for-tat exchanges mean all that much. I think sort of if you step back, I think we're in this weird sort of operational semi-pause, which is to say that for the last couple of months there, it's been pretty clear that Donald Trump wants to get out of this, right? He sees this kind of a mess. It was supposed to sort of end, you know, back in March. It's kind of drifting. The president keeps announcing that, you know, we're on the verge of a deal. CNN said the other day he's announced 37 times, apparently, in the last 2 months that, like, a deal was at hand. So it's pretty clear he wants to get out. He's even said that he's bored with the war, but he really can't, right? I mean, he's sort of stuck, right, politically, because if he just leaves and the strait stays closed, you know, or if the Iranians are allowed to charge tolls at the strait, which they're certainly going to demand if they get to keep their uranium, then it's going to look like Trump lost or was defeated. Now, I think in the strategic community, there's already a sense that the United States lost, right? But I think Trump is really wary about that impression going into an election in the fall. And so he's trying to sort of like pressure the Iranians, but he doesn't want to invade Iran, which is probably the only way to get a sort of decisive defeat of the Iranians. But he doesn't just want to leave because they'll look bad on TV and he can see the election coming up. So we're in this weird limbo, you know, and they're going to be. So my guess is for the next couple of months, you'll see these kinds of back and forth, sort of these minor strikes. But Trump doesn't really want to escalate to win because he's worried about the level of violence. He's worried about a quagmire. And so my real concern actually is that the Americans are going to slowly drift away from this thing. And the Israelis and the Iranians are going to kind of run away with this and just freelance and start fighting on their own. And it's not going to listen to Donald Trump at all, right? That's why I think Trump's been on TV in the last couple of days talking about how, you know, he's telling Bibi Netanyahu what to do and stuff like that. Because I think the war is beginning to slip away from the Americans. You know, we're just kind of losing control of it.
The optics looking bad and Trump apparently in a dilemma. Professor Pinkston, so the same question to you. How do you view the latest tit-for-tat between the United States and Iran?
Right. I'd have to echo a lot of things Professor Kelly said. I've been confused since this war has started what the strategic aims and goals are. So normally you begin with an outcome you wish to achieve, and then you walk back the kind of strategy and tactics you use and how you use military force and other instruments of national power, but that's never been coherent. And I think these people in the Trump administration, they're just not serious people. So they're repeating a lot of mistakes. If you look at history, there were thinkers back 100 years ago with theories about aerial bombing, Duhett and Billy Mitchell and others who claimed that aerial bombing would totally change the nature of warfare, and you would be able to bomb capitals or people into submission. But anybody who studied it at all, even casually, in undergraduate courses, you would know that that didn't occur in World War II. The bombing of London and the Blitz and everything, it didn't force the British to surrender. In fact, it stiffened their resolve. Or aerial bombing of Japan by the U.S. until the atomic bombings. Aerial bombing in Vietnam War. It's just not a sufficient instrument of coercion when a nation is unified and has the resolve to withstand it. People forget that Iran is quite a large country. I think it's about three times the size of Iraq, about three times the population. Professor Kelly can correct me if I'm wrong. But it's mountainous. It's very difficult to control. There were assumptions that by decapitating the leadership that Iran would collapse or there would be a revolution from below. And it appears that the hardliners are in charge and they've actually been strengthened. I'm not a specialist in Iranian domestic politics and bureaucratic politics and all of that. But there seems to be no evidence of any fracturing of the regime or a bottom-up uprising. And Iran still has a number of military capabilities that they can roll out. They haven't destroyed all of their military capabilities. And also there's advantages to the defender. And I just don't see them surrendering or just simply doing what Donald Trump wants them to do or tells them to do or what Hegseth, Secretary of Defense Hegseth, demands in a mean tweet. So I see this thing kind of dragging out. The Iranians have a number of advantages. I think the domestic political pressures in the U.S. will increase. And as Professor Kelly said, Trump will want to get out of this in some way. But I don't see any theory of victory or how they actually back out of this that looks like some kind of win or that the situation is better off than when this thing started.
Mm. Some World War One, World War Two, and Japan and Vietnam War era names being dropped there by Professor Pinkston in references to historical lessons about bombing's effectiveness in forcing an enemy to surrender. But Professor Pinkston, we're going to go back to you again for the second question. In response to the renewed U.S. strikes, Iran also issued a statement that their military would close the Strait of Hormuz, quote, immediately to all vessels. U.S. Central Command rejected that assertion. However, Iran said any vessel attempting to pass through the strait will be shot at. Professor Pinkston, what does this development mean for the strait and trade in general?
Well, I think the U.S. can't really counter that, and the U.S. can't put together a coalition of partners that are willing to counter that. So this is very problematic. The Strait of Hormuz was open before this conflict started. And now this has been handed to the Iranians. And what is going to happen and what is already underway is that countries in the region are going to have to reach some accommodation with Iran. I think it was very clever. They announced recently that they would charge an environmental fee for passage, which I think was very clever. Mm. You know, environmental protection of the strait. So they can always pull that out in countries that are dependent upon the supplies of oil from the Persian Gulf. Countries like, of course, Republic of Korea, Japan, are going to have to reach some accommodation. And then we see these attacks against bases, U.S. bases and other military facilities in the Gulf. And those countries are beginning to doubt or the security assurances of the U.S. or what the U.S. can provide. And any statements that come out of the White House is not credible. So states are going to have to find their own way with U.S. reputation being severely damaged.
For our next question, we go to Professor Kelly. President Trump on Wednesday had threatened further bombing of Iran should Tehran continue to decline peace proposals from Washington. On social media, the American president said Iran would, quote, pay the price. How do the recent strikes change your assessment of the prospects for a peace deal? Professor Kelly, and do you think that these threats will generate a peace deal?
Yeah, I think at this point, the Iranians have really taken a punch and proved that they can get through it. So I'm not really sure if smaller strikes are going to change their opinions, right? I mean, the Americans, we hit them pretty hard back in March. We threw a lot at them. I think there were something like 13,000 separate sorties. That's a lot. Mm. And the Iranians didn't break. I think it's pretty clear that Trump thought they were going to. I think in retrospect, we're kind of learning that the Israelis, Benjamin Netanyahu specifically, kind of convinced Trump that this thing would be kind of easy, turned out not to be. And now Trump is really stuck. So, I mean, at this point, you know, like I said in the answer to my first question, you know, I think he just kind of wants to get out of this thing, sort of realizes he's in over his head. But, you know, if he's going to actually, as you said, sort of like push the Iranians, coerce the Iranians into terms that the Americans want, the big thing, like Dan was saying, is getting the strait back open, he's going to have to hit the Iranians a lot harder. And again, as Dan also said, I think he's bumping up against the limits of air power. You know, and Dan's point was right here, which is that, again, you know, I mean, if the Trump people were a little bit more competent, to be quite honest, I think they would have known this. I mean, the idea that air power can win wars, that's an old idea, and it's been debunked again and again. There's a long history in strategic theory on this, you know, and people who do this professionally have known this for a long time, right? And the Trump people just kind of wandered back into this thing, right? You know, sort of, you know, I mean, it didn't work in Vietnam. I mean, I don't know. We don't have time for all that here. But I mean, there's a pretty long history of the U.S. trying to use air power to sort of achieve these sort of major outcomes, and it didn't work. And, you know, Trump kind of stumbled into this. So now, you know, you ask about these sort of like pinpoint strikes and smaller strikes. That's not enough, right? If Trump really wants to win this thing from the air, he is going to have to really unload on Iran. He's going to have to follow through on these threats that he was making before about ending Iranian civilization and blowing up the power facilities and blowing up dams. You know, and if he does that, he's going to be damned in global media as, you know, attacking civilians and collectively punishing Iran for its regime. I mean, he doesn't really want to do that. It's pretty clear he wants to sort of like get out. He doesn't want to escalate the level of violence because that'll sort of damage his reputation and at least maybe the United States getting sucked in further and further. But unless he's willing to escalate, I just don't think he can get from the Iranians what he wants. He's not going to get the strait back open. He's not going to get the uranium unless either he really, really goes hard from the air. I mean, just an unprecedented level of violence, or if he goes in on the ground. My own sense is that at this point, Trump can probably only get the Iranians to terms from an invasion, which we know he doesn't want to do because he's worried about Iraq. So again, I think Trump is just stuck in this limbo where, you know, he wants to win because he wants to look good on TV and for his voters and everything back home, but he's not willing to use the level of force necessary to do it. Because to do it, he'd have to kill tens of thousands of civilians, and that would that would damn him in the history books. Then he's Lyndon Johnson all over again.
Mm. So so far, the assessment from our two experts today is that Trump wants to find a way out, preferably in a very graceful manner. Professor Pinkston, we go back to you. Earlier this week, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Trump have asserted that a peace deal is imminent. This is something that they have said before. Professor Pinkston, do you think a peace deal is closer this time around?
Well, not based on anything they've said. Your guess, or anyone can speculate about that. I wouldn't trust any statements. You know, a peace deal is imminent. I'll believe it when I see it.
Professor Kelly, we're going to refocus our viewpoint, back to South Korea. With regard to the Iran war, President Lee Jae-myung recently made comments during his tour in Europe. On Wednesday, in an interview with The Economist, President Lee said that the Iran war will make North Korea even less likely to give up its nuclear program. The report said that, quote, Lee, in keeping with Democratic Party tradition, has made every effort to reach out, end of quote, to North Korea, but that the reclusive state, again, quote, which in recent years has taken to calling South Korea a hostile state and is now enjoying the fruits of a new alliance with Russia, has shown no interest in talking to the South. Professor Kelly, do you agree with that assessment made by The Economist in their interview with President Lee Jae-myung, or actually I should say the remarks from President Lee Jae-myung? Do you agree or do you disagree?
I think that assessment is basically correct. You know, the Iranians just withstood a pretty big American punch. You know, I mean, it's not a decisive victory of the United States, but within the context of the conflict, I mean, they beat us. And so if you're, you know, the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians, who've kind of been sort of working together in the last few years, right? The Iranians have just proven that, you know, you can withstand a major American assault, you know? And so, you know, if the United States comes to East Asia, if we've learned anything from this Iran conflict, is that American air power isn't going to be decisive. I mean, to me, that's sort of the big lesson for East Asia. I would actually be more worried about this if I were Taiwan than South Korea, because the Americans have just sort of learned that it's actually pretty difficult to operate U.S. aircraft carriers near an enemy well-armed with drones and cheap missiles. In the South Korean case, I think what this does is it just sort of bolsters, it makes things even more difficult with North Korea, because it sort of bolsters North Korea's perception that they've thrown in with the right gang here with the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians. Again, so the Iranians are kind of the weak link, I suppose, in this axis of resistance that we're talking about. But to be fair to the Iranians, I mean, they just proved that they sort of deserve full membership, I guess. I mean, they just beat us on TV, right? And so I think, you know, if you're the Iranian, even if you're the North Koreans, you're like, you know, I'm doing pretty well. So I don't think it makes a big deal. Actually, I think if I were South Korea, my guess is the big issue in South Korea is not sort of greater North Korean intransigence. It's probably that you guys are going to have to pay the tolls to get the oil. And that's probably going to feed through to Korean consumers. Gas is probably going to get more expensive. I think that's a big effect you guys will see in the next 2 years. But for your question about North Korea, yeah, this is only going to stiffen the North Koreans' perception that this axis of autocracy or this gang of autocracies standing up to the Americans is working out, that they made the right choice.
So Professor Kelly's assessment being North Korea can draw lessons from Iran, one being keep your nuclear weapons and that there is a way to resist air assaults from the United States. Professor Pinkston, we go to you with the same question. What is your take on President Lee Jae-myung's comments to The Economist? How do you think the war is affecting inter-Korean relations?
Well, as far as the North Korean leadership's view on nuclear weapons, that's already baked in. I mean, that's overdetermined. You didn't need this Iran situation to convince them of that. But a thing I'd like to add to this, and looking at these confrontations or conflicts between with the great power asymmetries, you can go back to the American Revolution, the American bunch of barefoot farmers fighting the greatest military in the world, the British. The Vietnamese fighting the Americans. You look now at the Ukrainians fighting the Russians. And this standoff and conflict between the Americans and the Iranians. On the Iranian side, they don't have to win. They just have to not lose. Hmm. So, you know, the Americans have to win and impose their will and coerce the Iranians to accept a war termination that suits the United States preferences. And Iran can just hold out. Just like the Vietnamese could hold out against the U.S. So they can play the long game, coming up in the fall with elections and so forth. There's, political pressures rising in the U.S., people concerned about inflation, cost of living, gas prices, being drawn into another war. Hmm. And people in this coalition and J.D. Vance supporters and so forth, they had promised that they would, return to a kind of neo-isolationism and not get involved in wars abroad. And this just contradicts all of those, policy statements and promises and platforms that they were running on. And I think even in their coalition of supporters are starting to, back away from this position. So I think the political pressures are going to be increasing in the U.S. And Iran just have to not lose.
Mm. I would love to have a debate about whether there are lessons to be drawn by the Trump administration from the U.S. Civil War when the other side, the power that had to go in and actually defeat an enemy in their home turf, the Union, are there any lessons to be drawn from there? But I guess we are not with the time luxury to go into that debate. But Professor Kelly, the last question that we have today is, what do you expect to see next, or what should we keep an eye about for moving forward regarding the situation in Iran?
Yeah, so I think before the election, Trump can't withdraw because it'll look like a defeat on TV, and the Republicans will take a beating because of that. The Democrats will sort of gleefully say Donald Trump lost a war. Like I said, I think in the strategic community, sort of groups that people like Dan and I move with, I think there's already sort of a general sense that the Americans lost. As Dan said, the Iranians can win just by not losing. Trump to really overcome that, Trump would have to escalate massively. It's pretty clear he doesn't want to do that. He's been looking for an exit for the last 2 months. So I think the practical reality is that we lost, but Trump won't permit that to be said on television because it'll hurt him politically, so he'll stay in there at least until November, right? That is to say, the American blockade of the Gulf of Oman, even if it's leaky, that will stay in place, right? And there'll be more of these sort of tit-for-tat strikes. You know, the Iranians will shoot an American ship and we'll shoot back. So I would imagine that we're kind of in this like weird stasis, this kind of like weird quasi-war limbo. I'm not even sure if that's a word, but yeah, I think that's where we are. And then the real thing is after the election, right? When Trump basically has to make a decision to either make his best effort to win, which again, I think requires a level of force he just won't tolerate, or what he'll probably do, and this is my guess, is that he'll slowly retrench. The U.S. Navy will kind of slowly fade away. Trump will talk about how there are other things more important, and you know, you can't just keep U.S. sailors floating out there in the Arabian Sea for years and stuff like that, and it will just, the Americans will pull back. Trump won't actually say publicly that, you know, we lost or anything like that. No way. But there'll be some kind of informal deal behind the scenes. But my guess is the Iranians come out of this, A, being able to charge tolls on the strait. So if you're an oil importer from the Gulf like South Korea, your gas prices are going to go up. I think that's almost set. I'm not sure South Korea and Japan and others can get out of that. And B, the Iranians, more, I think maybe more important strategically, is the Iranians get to keep their highly enriched uranium. And, you know, and that was supposed to be the casus belli, right? I mean, that was the reason why we went to war. But the only way the Iranians are going to give that up is if we really hit them hard, which Trump just doesn't want to do. So my sense is that this will sort of drag on. The short answer is this drags on through November and then just kind of fades away. And the, whether or not the Israelis and the Iranians keep going at it, I think Trump has kind of lost that. And so that might continue. But I think the American role, we're just going to sort of like fade away after the election.
Well, that's all we have time for today. The assessment here is that Trump wants to get out, but there isn't an easy way out at the moment. That was Professor Robert Kelly at Busan National University and Professor Daniel Pinkston at Troy University. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 33.13 points or 0.43% on Thursday to close at 7,763.95. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 45.3 points or 4.76% to close at 996.93. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
Good to see you again, Dan. What's our first story today?
It is finally time. Friday, 11 a.m. Korea Standard Time, South Korea's national men's football team will be playing their 2026 FIFA World Cup group stage match, going up against Czech Republic for their first Group A match at Estadio Guadalajara over in Mexico. On the eve of the match, Captain Son Heung-min talked about his mindset heading into the game.
Finally, the World Cup is here. So what did the legendary team captain Son Heung-min have to say ahead of game day?
At the pre-match press conference, he said his teammates will be ready to give their everything and more, adding that they're so fired up and even willing to stake their lives on it that Son actually had to work hard to calm them down. Have a listen.
There are three group stage matches, but each one of them, in a way, feels like the most important game of our lives. So rather than thinking too far ahead, we're focused on making the most of today's remaining training session. Every World Cup match is so important that we'll be willing to stake our lives on it. Tomorrow, we'll give everything we've got and more.
I think this is on every fan's mind. Will this be Son's final World Cup?
At 33, he is considered to be in the twilight of his career in terms of soccer terms. And many experts believe this one, his fourth World Cup, is highly likely to be his last. However, Captain Son never officially announced that this is his last World Cup. Instead of dwelling on that question, he said he feels like a child again to be on this grand global stage and that the focus is only on getting the job done.
Son Heung-min is a name that's already been etched into the walls of Korean football. So, Dan, can you help us look back at how Son imposed his presence in past World Cups and what kind of records he could be setting in this one?
He clearly left his imprint in the game. He scorched his first World Cup goal as a 21-year-old in the 2014 edition, donned the Taeguk patch in both 2018 and 2022, compiling three career World Cup goals along the way, currently tied with fellow football legends An Jong-hwan and Park Ji-sung. So aside from winning the Premier League Golden Boot, claiming the FIFA Puskas Award and captaining Tottenham Hotspur to the UEFA Europa League title, Son could be adding another historic accomplishment in this World Cup. But the captain seems focused on the big picture beyond personal accolades, though. He clearly stated that he's all about finding ways to make plays that can best help the team.
And ahead of the first group stage match for this World Cup, what did the head coach, Hong Myung-bo of Team Korea, have to say about his expectations?
Coach Hong said he is confident in his players and that he is very confident also about the preparations for the match. Have a listen.
The World Cup is, without a doubt, the ultimate stage every Korean football player dreams of. As we prepare for this tournament, I believe our team left no stone unturned.
Listeners of this show and myself have heard of the unique environment where Game Team Korea will be playing. Were there any unique training and preparation methods implemented ahead of Friday's game?
Yes, there was. It's about altitude. Hong said he was pleased with how the team got adjusted to playing in high altitude by training in another elevated city, Salt Lake City, Utah, for about 3 weeks over in the U.S. This is before competing at the Estadio Guadalajara, which is about 1,500 meters above sea level.
So how has the communication between players and coaching staff been like?
Well, Coach Hong said he has already spoken to players on many occasions, that he may not even need to deliver any special prep talk on the day of the match, and that he focused on creating an environment where the players can have fun and compete with high energy.
Well, best of luck to Team Korea. But moving on to our next story, what do you have for us, Dan?
The South Korean government announced it's reviewing the so-called father first surname principle, a rule that requires children to automatically take the father's last name.
I'm surprised that the rule is still in place.
Technically, since 2005, parents can choose to give the child the mother's surname, actually, but they must agree to it at the time of marriage registration before the child is even born. You have to check a box on the marriage registration form saying you've discussed giving the child the mother's name, and the process isn't straightforward at all, as you can tell.
So it's a little bit difficult. I presumed this is rare. I personally don't know anyone who has not followed their father's last name. But how rare is this in practice?
Well, it's apparently very rare. In 2021, there were only about 600 such cases nationwide, a twofold spike from 2018, but still accounts for just 0.2% of all births. The option exists on paper, but almost no one uses it.
I guess I know the answer to this next question, but why not? Is it just tradition or is there something more to it?
I think tradition is a big part there, a system of tradition dating all the way back to the Joseon Dynasty, so that's about six centuries of deeply embedded culture. Even during Japanese colonial rule, when Japan tried to impose a shared surname system, Koreans kept their separate surname tradition. There's also social pressure, though. One husband interviewed for a recent article said even if his wife had wanted their child to take her name, he would have found it hard to agree because it would mean doing something different from everyone around them. Some parents also worry that their child might be labeled as coming from a single parent or divorced family.
So what's the Korean government actually proposing to do now?
The Ministry of Gender Equality and Family confirmed a new five-year family policy plan, the fifth basic plan for healthy families covering 2026 to 2030. One of the key items is reviewing how children's surnames are determined to better reflect gender equality. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women has also previously urged Korea to revise the relevant civil code provision. Officials say no specific direction has been decided yet because it's tied to a lot of other legal issues, family registration, kinship law, and so on. But the broader goal is to give families more genuine flexibility, and not just a theoretical option buried in paperwork.
Well, then that begs the question, has anything like this been tried before?
Yeah, the stronger version where father surnames were legally mandatory was abolished back in 2008 when Korea scrapped the old family registry system, but the father-first default remained. What the government is now saying is that even that default needs to be reconsidered.
So deeply ingrained traditions, including in the law. But moving on to our final story, Dan, what do you have for us?
OpenAI CEO Sam Altman will be visiting South Korea for meetings with major Korean tech firms next week.
Right after Jensen Huang of NVIDIA. But do we have a rough idea of what his itinerary will be for Mr. Altman?
According to industry sources on Thursday, he will arrive on Sunday for a two-day visit and expected to hold meetings with executives from Samsung Electronics and portal operator Naver, as well as mobile platform operator Kakao, to discuss cooperation in, of course, artificial intelligence.
We know that Jensen Huang had some fancy chicken soju beer meetings with the Korean chaebol CEOs and owners, but are there any details on Sam Altman perhaps repeating those types of meetings?
Well, he's on a very tight schedule. On Monday, Altman is expected to meet Kakao CEO Jung Shin-ah at the company's headquarters in Pangyo, south of Seoul, to discuss ways to expand cooperation, especially on strengthening connectivity between ChatGPT and KakaoTalk, Kakao's flagship messaging device or service. Altman is expected to visit Naver's headquarters in Seongnam later the same day. As Naver has built its own cloud and data center infrastructure, some experts believe the two sites could be finding new areas of cooperation between OpenAI and South Korean internet giant.
Well, that will come at a bit awkward time because Kakao is going through its share of labor strife. But will Mr. Altman's brief tour involve mostly meetings with top officials of these mega firms?
Actually, he is also scheduled to visit Samsung's office in Suwon, south of Seoul, on Monday to deliver a lecture on the transformative impact of AI technologies and strategies for AI-driven workplace innovation. This comes as the Korean tech giant recently announced plans to fundamentally overhaul its work processes and corporate culture by fully incorporating AI across its operations.
That's all we have time for today. This was great stuff.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello everybody, my name is B-Boy Phil Wizard and I am the Breaking Gold Medalist from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
We've come to our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we wander off the beaten path into the country's artistic and cultural oases. And today we're joined by Cho Jung-woo, a Seoul City reporter from the Korea Jungang Daily. Welcome, Ms. Cho.
Hello.
So, what do you have for us today?
Well, if you've been around Seoul Forest recently, you may have noticed that the area looks a little different. That's because the 2026 Seoul International Garden Show is now underway. It's actually the largest edition of the event ever held, and it has transformed not only Seoul Forest, but also parts of the surrounding neighborhoods into one giant garden exhibition.
I'm probably one of the several million people who've seen the posters in the Seoul subway advertising this show. But for listeners who may not be familiar with the Seoul International Garden Show, Ms. Cho, could you tell us more about what this show is?
Well, the show is an annual festival organized by the Seoul Metropolitan Government that showcases garden design, landscaping, and urban green spaces. And this year's event features 167 gardens created by landscape architects, corporations, institutions, students, and ordinary citizens. The show runs for 6 months from May through October, making it both the largest and longest running edition to date.
So it's the longest running to date, but the word large can have many different meanings. Is there anything else that makes the show this year the largest besides the sheer number of gardens?
The exhibition stretches well beyond Seoul Forest itself. The gardens are connected along a roughly 10-kilometer route linking Seoul Forest, the Han River, and nearby neighborhoods in the Seongdong and Gwangjin districts. And altogether, the festival spans around 710,000 square meters.
I saw your story, and it seems that you actually visited before the official opening. What was that experience like?
Well, as someone who loves lush greenery and colorful flowers, it was an assignment I genuinely enjoyed covering. And everywhere you look, it's just waves of green and vibrant colors. And I think it's a perfect getaway for locals and tourists who might be a bit bored of the usual indoor photo spots and pretty cafes and are looking for something fresh to do in Seoul. To me, what stood out most was how the show harmoniously blends contemporary trends and K-culture with horticultural art. The director of the show guided me during my visit and explained that they intentionally reflected urban trends, especially since the neighboring Seongsu-dong has become such a global symbol of K-culture and a major tourist hotspot.
So you had a personal tour, so to speak. Were there any gardens or installations that particularly stood out to you?
As soon as I walked through the main entrance, I spotted walls decorated with Lego flowers. They looked so realistic from afar that I had to walk up close just to check if they were actually made of Legos. And while I loved taking in all the artistic and serene garden designs, a couple of unique ones really stuck with me. There was a very moving installation featuring a pavilion built around a 150-year-old char tree. The tree was recovered from the forest fires in Andong North, Gyeongsang Province, and it was put on display to raise awareness about natural disasters.
And that wildfire was horrible. It's nice that the organizers have found a way to raise awareness about the danger of wildfires. But I understand there is a very specific design concept greeting the visitors right at the gate.
Yeah, that's right. It's called the Welcome Garden, and this year it features a massive installation named the Sky Fun Pavilion. The city government designed a layered structure made of overlapping circular elements that frame the sky and captures natural lighting. It's blended in white and yellow, which is Seoul's official color of the year for 2026, and they've also placed beanbags, rocking chairs, and flexible benches right underneath it. And at night, they turn on these beautiful lights, turning it into a popular photo spot.
Sounds very pretty. Speaking of popularity, this event has a massive target audience this year, doesn't it? And even a famous honorary ambassador?
Yeah. The city is actually aiming for 50 million visitors over its six-month run, building on the 10 million people who visited last year, which was held at Porame Park. And in just the first 20 days since the opening, the show has already attracted over 2.5 million visitors. To help draw in the crowds and connect with younger generations, Chung Won, who's the leader of the K-pop boy band ENHYPEN, was named the official honorary ambassador for the show.
I feel like I'm getting old. It's very tough to keep track of all the top K-pop singers of today. What kind of themed gardens can visitors, both K-pop fans and K-pop laypeople like myself, expect to see?
Well, for K-pop fans, there's a specialized garden that actually incorporates iconic K-pop light sticks into the green arrangements. There are also fan-donated forests honoring artists like BTS's J-Hope and aespa's Winter. And if you prefer something traditional, they have Korean heritage gardens inspired by traditional Hanok architecture that provide a really serene look into the past.
I might be a little more old school than most K-pop fans, but it sounds like a fantastic bridge between the old and new. For families out there, is there anything kid-friendly?
Well, not just for families, but for all ages, there is a major treat for Pokemon fans. The Pokemon Secret Forest features multiple statues of Pikachu standing in the greenery, along with other beloved characters like Squirtle and Bulbasaur. It was incredibly cute to see these characters tucked away in the gardens. It almost felt as if they were actually walking around out in nature. There are also several photo spots set up in this area. You can take photos in front of the Phantom's hideout, which is designed like an old house where different Pokemon characters are actually standing on the roof. And popular lifestyle, fashion, and cosmetics brands have also created their own corporate gardens. And an instant noodle company even put together a garden called Spicy Happiness and Noodles to mark the 40th anniversary of products.
I'd love to see some of the Pokemon there, actually. And I could also use some instant noodles right now. I'm getting very hungry. But are there more serious themes to the gardens?
Oh, well, absolutely. Beyond the pop culture, there is a real focus on sustainability and innovation. In one space, there is a symbolic patch of earth where oak saplings sprout from ash, representing nature's resilience. The city notes that these gardens are expected to absorb around 5,630 tons of carbon annually. There is also an installation called Breathing Earth, which is a moving garden where the land art physically rises and falls at the touch of a button.
It's great to see that the show is very green. But I also read in your story that the garden show isn't just local. It has a very global and collaborative feel to it. Ms. Cho, can you tell us more about the international participants?
Yes. There are world-renowned architects showcasing their work, including a highly anticipated piece called The Garden of Eternal Flow by famous French architect Henri Bava. They also held an international competition and selected five exceptional featured gardens designed by teams from Italy, India, China, and Korea. The best part is that these international competition pieces won't be torn down. They are going to remain in Seoul Forest as permanent fixtures, even after the festival wraps up in October.
So for our listeners who want to visit, what do they need to know in terms of convenience, hours, and tickets?
Well, the gardens are free and open to the public around the clock, though the official program hours and specific installations run from noon to 8 p.m. And to accommodate global visitors, the city has placed QR codes at each garden that provide information in 9 different languages, including English, Chinese, Japanese, and Spanish. They've also doubled the amount of seating to over 4,600 benches and chairs and expanded the food truck zones to 5 different spots so you can grab a bite while you enjoy the greenery.
And do you have any final insider tips for people heading there?
Well, since it's been relatively hot lately and Seongsu-dong is a crowded area, I highly recommend bringing a hat, sunglasses, and a bottle of water. And even though the organizers intentionally added extra seating areas for visitors to rest this year, a lot of the paths are wide open to the sun, and it can be quite difficult to find shade when you're walking between the different gardens. So definitely dress for the heat and stay hydrated while you explore.
And that is a great reminder, especially with the summer heat kicking in early. Now, if listeners want a more guided experience to learn about these gardens, are there tours available?
Yes, there are actually docent tours offered in both Korean and English every single day. For the English tours, visitors can book them in advance through Naver Booking. In June, September, and October, the English tours run twice a day at 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. But during the peak hot summer months of July and August, the schedule gets pushed back to 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. to keep things cooler. Each tour lasts for an hour, but just keep in mind that they only run if bookings are made ahead of time, and a minimum of 4 visitors must book at least 1 hour prior to the tour start time.
So book ahead of time if you want the tour, and be sure to bring mom and dad and any siblings or kids and nephews and nieces, since you have to have at least 4 people for the tour. Are there any special events or alternative tour programs people should know about?
Yeah, there is a dedicated tour program for multicultural families happening at 4 p.m. every Saturday this month. Just like the general tours, bookings are handled through the same Naver system, and the time will also be pushed back to 5 p.m. on Saturdays during July and August. On top of that, the entire show features multiple live music performances and programs like flea markets. But events are constantly changing, so I highly recommend checking their website to see what's happening on the day you plan to go.
And as a final question, remind us where listeners can look up more details if they want to plan a trip.
You can find program schedules, map routes, and more details on the official Seoul International Garden Show website and its Instagram account, as well as the Seoul Metropolitan Government website. And the show will run through October 27th, so there is still lots of time to catch it.
Thank you for all the awesome stuff today, Ms. Cho. That was it for today's segment of Explore Korea.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back tomorrow. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio On Air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. As always, thank you for listening. Goodbye. Yeah.